students are totally catching on to the BS that is higher education. They know now in a way that I feel like we didn't know. I think what is needed is a complete renovation of university leadership.
For generations, people have regarded higher education as a bastion of free and progressive thought. But in recent years, the ills of academia, its deeply rooted misogyny and racism and gatekeeping, have been brought to the fore. This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. As an academic myself, I'm keenly aware of both the myths and shortcomings of the institutions of research in higher education. Yet I've remained generally optimistic, despite academia's undeniable turn towards profit and away from social responsibility. Today, I'm talking about the future of academia with Dr. Shoshana Jacobs. Shoshana is a colleague of mine at the University of Guelph, one who has been very vocal in their critique of how universities responded to the pandemic, while also remaining creative and innovative in their own teaching. We talk about the failures of the moment and the bold new futures in higher education that are possible if we can remake our institutions around the values of care and equity and trust. Let's dig in. Today, we're talking about the future of higher education with Dr. Shoshana Jacobs. Over the past couple of years, as university communities have grappled with and contested how best to respond to the challenges of COVID-19, I've watched with interest as Shoshana and some of their close colleagues have actively stood up for students, pushed administrations to be creative and to do better, and watched them be incredibly creative in how they've adapted their courses to online and hybrid options. Shoshana, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be able to dream big with you.
Let's start at the beginning, because I think the long arc of how the pandemic has disrupted colleges and universities, how it's created both conflicts and opportunities for innovation, is a really important story about change. My perspective on this is, you know, when the lockdowns and closures hit, we were all mid-semester, right? We're all in the middle. We didn't quite know what was coming. We certainly did not have the benefit of hindsight to realize how significant it was going to be, right? And I think we all saw some things that we were less than happy with in terms of the short-term responses. We'll get to the long-term responses in a minute, but in terms of the short-term responses of our institutions. So that's my brief perspective on it. I'm curious to hear about, in the first few months, what bubbled up for you.
So as soon as the pandemic hit, I think the thing that I noticed most was a difference in both the level of preparation and understanding of the academic system by instructors who were making decisions on behalf of their students for how to move forward, in addition to the very big difference in the personal lives and personal challenges of instructors and how those two combined when they were trying to figure out whether they were going to be able to continue to offer their courses or not. And I think one of the big struggles that we have is that those two aspects, the sort of lack of understanding of the system and also then the differences in the personal situations, were never fully teased out such that the decisions that instructors made were kind of categorized based on sort of more superficial perceptions of their commitment to education. And I think that was a real struggle at the very beginning. And so we immediately became divided camps. And that was rather difficult, I think, both for, you know, the instructors, but also for their students.
Yeah, the your point about divided camps, I feel that, because we were, and, you know, from an academic perspective, as somebody who thinks a lot about how people respond to crisis, the last thing that you want to be if you're going to respond effectively is divided. But that's what happened. And I mean, I think it's an interesting question to ask if those were cracks that were already there, or if that was just a lack of preparedness. You know, there's we could talk a lot about issues that have emerged in terms of equity. And I think were we always just assuming that our universities were really these tremendously progressive institutions of, you know, seeking equity and inclusion? But then what it turns out, you know, we came up short in a number of ways in terms of making sure everybody was protected, making sure some people didn't experience more harm than others.
I think you're right. I think many of us probably walked around in a bit of a bubble thinking that there was this sort of uniform commitment to the values and the mission of the institution. And I think one of the things that we realized is that there is quite a bit of variation in that commitment at all levels of the system, from a course level with the instructors to the dean's offices to, and then maybe perhaps for me, I hate to even say that I was naive in thinking that there was great commitment at the university leadership level, but oh my goodness. If I didn't suspect it before, it was absolutely confirmed with COVID-19. There were so many opportunities to make decisions that followed the letter of our EDI statements and all of those things that are on our splashy web pages. And consistently, those things weren't done. And I think that I can be forgiving, understanding, even at the level of the course. You know, again, all of our personal lives, some of us had very young children, some of us were taking care of elders, and all of those things that made it really difficult to make decisions outside of our own personal bubble in the context of a global pandemic. But university leadership, though, I feel sort of more personally pained or wronged when we saw those types of decisions being made at the higher levels of our system.
One of those that really stuck out for me that I still don't know quite what to do with was how, you know, when the prospect emerged of having to end a semester early, of maybe having to forego finals or do finals remote, it pulled the curtain back on this tendency among some or many faculty, you know, administrators to gatekeep. You know, it gave this impression that they don't trust students. You know, so much has been given to the technological pivot, doing things online, all the amazing things we've done with software. But then you get programs like Respondus or Invigilator, which privacy invading programs that start from the assumption that students are going to cheat, and they're tremendously ableist, they're invasive. And I'm still not sure what to do with that myself. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on how we move forward from some of that sort of harm.
The harm is so deep that, to me, and I've had some time to think about this, because the only thing that I've been able to do as an individual faculty member with tenure and all of the privilege that comes with that is to provide students with the text that they need to fight for their own rights and to advocate for themselves. This is as far as my power has allowed me to go. And while I feel as though it has been beneficial for some students, it is not enough. Hmm. And I don't know what we as individuals can do despite the privilege and the power that we have. I think what is needed is a complete renovation of university leadership. I think we need to rethink how we hire these people. And I think we need to reset our priorities. And I think we need to evaluate them just as we have been evaluated for, you know, forever, and that have consequences. I think our leaders need to be evaluated. And I think the rubric has to include the values and the mission of and the vision of the institution and how we are adhering to those. And I know that sounds harsh, but oh my goodness, in one memo, there was an acknowledgement that Respondus violates human rights, followed by a violation of our students' human rights, even in the way that we set it up so that they could express concern I just couldn't understand. I couldn't reconcile how that could be written.
For the listeners, you're talking about an episode where the university acknowledged the human rights challenges of programs like Respondus and Invigilator, but then proceeded to allow instructors to use those at their discretion and set it up so that anybody who would experience harm as a result had to be their own advocates. It was all very confusing.
Like, I just couldn't get it. And so given the fact that this is not just a single institutional problem, right? The one thing I think that has virtually killed our ability to call for a revolution in higher education is the fact that this is happening across Canada, right? Across North America, and potentially, you know, across the world, where these leaders are making these terrible decisions. And I think it really calls for a rethink of university post-secondary education. I think there are models that might work better, and I think we need to have a very long conversation about what that might look like.
I think that you're right. And, you know, I think that so much trust was lost. If nothing changes, if there is no course correction, that trust is not coming back. There is a big difference between people showing up to courses because they're required to get a degree and people wanting to join a community. But let's also turn to some of the positives, because I think it's positive on the one hand that these experiences pulled back the curtain, and there's lots of other things going on that are pulling back the curtain on what we have now. You know, the recent news about Harvard and sexual harassment there and the tremendously tone-deaf response that it received. But these things open up space to do things differently. I really think that, you know, as widespread as the terrible responses were, there was also widespread outrage over them, which to me means there's an appetite for change and a niche for change. So can you talk some about what you've been trying to do within the space that you have, what's working and what gets you excited?
I want to tell you what gets me excited first, because I think then it might speak to the small things that I'm also excited about that I've been doing in my classrooms and things. The thing that gets me excited, the thing that makes what's happening now different to me, is that students are totally catching on to the BS that is higher education. They know now in a way that I feel like we didn't know. Right? We were just going through the system. We were talking about how tough it is, but we were like accepting it as a thing that we had to do. And I think students now are willing to push back on accepting it as a thing that they have to do. And I am excited about that, because that might be where change comes from, right? If we can convince the sheep, and I don't really think that students are sheep, to go into that pen, then the pen will not change. But they're starting to question. And I think that that is really what gets me excited. So what I have been trying to do is to, within the limitations of the pen, and they suck, they're terrible. But within the limitations of the pen, I am constantly pushing and trying to ask questions about what our priorities are, what students really need, what I need as an educator, and you know, what a classroom can look like, what it can feel like, and what a first-year student, because I love first year, I love first-year courses, I love the big classrooms, what that can look like outside of the pen.
So what can it look like?
And so with the incredible privilege that I have, and oh my goodness, right? I am in a family of two tenured academics. We started to play a little bit of a long game in terms of trying to change our courses and trying to push these limits. And so for the last 2 years, I've taken my class of 600 students, but it was three sections of 600 because that was the size of the largest lecture theater at the university. Like, why do we have to limit our class to 600? It was because that was the physical space. But what might, you know, a non-physical class look like? How many could we support? How accessible could we make it? What could our students be doing? What new skills could they be learning and practicing? And so we've been tapping into it within the limitations of the pen though. And so, for example, you ask for resources and they tell you no. So then you volunteer your time and then you get it done. You know, all of that sort of classic story. Because we're privileged, we were able to do those types of things. And so we've been experimenting with what, you know, virtual space can feel like, where students can come together virtually and safely, what remote learning looks like, how we can send them things and get them to learn together, how we can leverage the fact that they're spread out around the world. I mean, we have students that are physically in Ethiopia, that are physically in Sri Lanka. Like, go outside and tell us what's there. How can we actually use it as a benefit to learning rather than simply trying to overcome it and fight it? So I'm really excited that our students are challenging us to do these things and ask these questions. And I'm really excited about what we might be able to do if we can overcome the problem. And I see this like so clearly, the problem of the leadership of higher education. That needs to change.
What you're describing to me, I mean, it excites me too. And in an earlier episode, I talked to Mark Brand, who's a chef out in Vancouver, and he's a social activist and he works on hunger and homelessness. And he said something to the effect of, imagine if just one city completely reorganized itself around taking care of people. Every other city would have to follow, because that's the one city where people would want to be. Imagine if one university completely reorganized itself around really taking care of and meeting the needs of their students. Everybody else would have to, because nobody would want to go anywhere else, right? There's so much opportunity.
There's an incredible opportunity. And quite recently, I've started to wonder who that voice needs to be in order to communicate that need, right? And I'm not sure who that person is, because I know the way that higher ed leaders respond to me. So I'm not going to be able to bring that message to them, right? It's not me. And I am desperately seeking that voice, that person who will be the effective communicator of that opportunity, because I fully agree with you that there are many of us that see it. And there are many of us that are absolutely willing to rally behind that voice that can make that case heard. There's just going to be this like boiling up of energy. And I hope it doesn't burst, because if we miss this opportunity, we will have done a massive disservice to all of the future students, right? Which essentially means to all of us.
You know, that's the thing about culture change, is that generally it can be so hard to change culture. And universities, if anything, have a culture, one that's been around for a long time and one that is extremely hard to change. But the pandemic showed us that culture and behavior can change so quickly. And I think you're right. I think it will be a tremendously missed opportunity if it's one that's left on the table. But you mentioned the voice. And in addition to the voice, I feel like there's also a need to figure out where the vision comes from. And maybe to some extent, maybe to a large extent, that comes from students. But, you know, right now the vision, it seems, is just about what's going to sell better. You know, I mean, and we can be cynical, but honestly, is the more programs you see seem to be things that are organized around revenue. Where does some of the vision come from?
I agree with you that the vision we have to start at like base levels, right? In our conversation, we need to figure out, you know, what the priorities are, what the goals are, what success looks like. And we need to make sure that all of those things, that there is a system to allow for what success looks like, what the goals are, to change over time, right? And we need to challenge everything, right? Because the whole system is set up not to educate. We have data to show this, that I can tell you what a university graduate's, you know, GPA is going to be based on their high school GPA, it means that we do nothing, right? If that relationship is linear and predictable, it means that we have no effect on them, right? We're not doing anything. And so we need to question everything. Why 4 years, right? Why is a three-year bachelor less than a four-year bachelor? Why 4 years? Why does it matter? And the whole system is meant simply to filter out. And that is not what a public service should do. I don't know what the new model would look like, but I do know how to get there. We need to have this national conversation, and it has to be at the national level to figure out what it is that higher education, university education, and universities in particular, colleges, they're doing okay. Like, things are okay, right? Like, people are learning stuff. They're getting skills. We have students that go from our university program to the college program to get skills so that they can do the things that they want. Like, I'm not worried about colleges in the way that I'm super worried about universities. And we have to question it all, and we have to rationalize it, because I don't think that the reasons for whatever we are doing hold up anymore.
Something you said a moment ago is lines up so well with the premise of why I put together this show, is that there's not just a change, there's a future. We don't necessarily have any idea what it's going to look like, but we know there's a process to get there. And can we create the space to really do that? And so I really appreciate that answer. And maybe that conversation is the answer to this last question that I ask everybody. You know, thinking radical change, what radical change in higher education would you like to see unfold in your lifetime?
I suppose that I have ideas about what my classroom might look like, or what, you know, my students might tell me, or the way that they would behave with each other. But I think for me, the radical change is probably not so radical. I would love it if any Canadian student could access the university education that they wanted. I would love it if they didn't have to move away or travel. I would love it if they could get there no matter where they are. I think that would probably be radical enough for me, just to be able to know that that students are where they want to be. I would very much like it if finances were not a barrier to accessing education. I would love it if previous education was not a barrier to accessing education. And so perhaps then, you know, what radical would look like is that there would be more diversity in my classrooms, across age groups, right? Across cultural groups, across ethnic groups, across everything. So radical would be open access to what it is that we're doing, I think. And getting there, of course, would mean that we have fundamentally changed our programs, right? Because 4 years, five courses a semester at tens of thousands of dollars is not open access. And I think if we can truly achieve access and diversity in our classes, then it means that we will have undergone radical change and real change. And so it is actually radical, I guess, because I'm not sure when we're going to get there. And I know that we are not going to get there until we change the vision and the mission, or we stick to the vision and the mission, and that means leadership changes.
I think that's radical change.
Is it?
But I think we can get there. Shoshana, this was great. I really appreciated this conversation.
I'm really grateful to you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is the Second Transition podcast. Today we heard from Dr. Shoshana Jacobs of the University of Guelph. You can learn more about their work in the episode notes. The Second Transition podcast is produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northeastern California. This podcast is made possible with support from the Arrow Food Institute at the University of Guelph and Voice Ed Radio. Be well, and see you next time.